Hey there, welcome to LSAT Demon Daily Digest. I'm Ben Olson, that's Nathan Fox. Together we're the founders of LSATdemon.com and our weekly podcast, Thinking LSAT. Here's what we talked about this week.
We have an email here from Shavar.
Good evening, my name is Shavar. I saw your YouTube channel and wanted to learn more about taking the LSAT. My GPA after this semester will likely be a 2.9 3.0 finance major. I'm at my third college, and I'm unsure how the GPA would be calculated if they were to combine three schools worth. It would likely be significantly lower. I'd like to get into a T14 law school and would be willing to put in the work necessary to obtain a 170 and up on the LSAT. I'm a non-traditional student, African-American, disabled veteran, and I'll be 29 this year. Will my age be an issue in the application process? I hope to hear from you soon.
Wow. No, your age is the least of your concerns.
Yeah, you got a big concern right now with your GPA, and it sounds like you haven't done much, if anything, with your LSAT score. So the two biggest factors in your application need to be addressed first.
Yeah, I wouldn't even go any further down this road without doing an LSAT practice test and seeing where you're at and studying for a little while and seeing if you're making progress. Boy, you're going to have to get your transcripts uploaded to the Credential Assembly Service. I'm wondering if, you know, hopefully maybe you qualify for, if you qualify for the LSAC fee waiver, Shavar, you know, which everybody should apply for the LSAC fee waiver. It's worth like a couple thousand dollars easily if you get it, because it'll give you the Credential Assembly Service for free, which is the first thing. And you need to do the Credential Assembly Service, Shavar. You need to have all your transcripts uploaded. You need to see what your LSAC GPA is actually going to be. You're speculating, but there's no point speculating. You should just get your transcripts uploaded and see what it is. 2.9 to 3.0, I mean, that indicates that you're not that good at school, or like your track record indicates that you're not that good at school. So law schools are going to look at that and go, well, this is a person who has a documented track record of being not that good at school. And as you say, if you get that 170 plus, you know, then they might be willing to consider your, like, and I'm not, 170 is not a magic number. It's just a shorthand. But if you get a really high LSAT, then at least you'd be showing them something about horsepower, English language, willingness to work hard that your undergrad record does not show.
Yeah. Getting his GPA from LSAC is a necessary step in this process. You're right. He is estimating. But even if he goes to LSATdemon.com/scholarships and just puts in 2.9, 3.0, just plays with those numbers, you can see how badly you're going to need a high LSAT score. You can check the URM box, obviously. That will help a little bit. But look at the hill you're facing and figure out what you got to do to get there.
I don't, you know, it's not, I wouldn't worry this non-traditional thing. 29 is not that's not a crazy age at all.
I think the average age of law
students is like, 33. Go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry. I think the average age is like 26 or something like that. So
yeah. So you're not, that's not like even surprisingly old at all. Plenty of people do plenty of stuff, including, you know, your status as a veteran should help you. Law schools love people who have like the military work ethic. So that's great, but they're going to have to report your GPA. And that's the part that they're going to be like, oh man, we're going to have to lower our median. Because, you know, you're way below the median at all of the T14. So it's like, you know, that's an anchor on your application. You are going to be lowering their median, which means that they're not going to be excited about admitting you unless you're raising their median LSAT. Yeah, the URM boost will help a little bit because there are just not that many people in law school who look like you. And that's great. But you're yeah, you are going to need a shining LSAT in order to have any kind of a credible candidacy at the T14, especially.
Yeah. By the way, I realized that on the Thinking LSAT podcast, we always say don't pay for law school when we close out the show. We need to emphasize that on this show too. Like, I don't want you going, getting a great score and then paying for law school. Like, go, please go for free.
Yeah.
Even if that means like that almost certainly means not a T14. So I don't think you can go to a T14 and go for free with your GPA, but, yeah, you don't need to go to a T14.
Well, but also Shavar might have GI Bill, yellow ribbon. So there are other ways potentially of not paying for law school.
That's true. Yep. We got an email here from Chris.
Says, hey guys, great work on Nathan, great work on figuring out HMFICs from my last email. That might have been on Thinking LSAT. I can't remember if that was from the Daily or Thinking LSAT. But HMFIC, of course, means head motherfuckers in charge. Chris says, I learned that in the military, I think, where there was always a staff non-commissioned officer in charge, SNCOIC, or an officer in charge, OIC. I guess in both cases, that's the HMFIC.
Got it. Okay. Yeah.
An attorney recommended this Vanderbilt Law Review article by Judge Patrick Schlitz from 1999. Schlitz is a federal judge in Minneapolis now, a Harvard grad, etc. You guys are doing the Lord's work by being so honest about the bleak reality of the work of lawyers, and yet so many of your listeners and readers and writers into the show seem to think that they will be immune to the soul-crushing demands of big law life. I'm only about a quarter into this article, but maybe you guys can skim it or share it on the podcast or blog or something. I think it's important reading. It's from 1999, but it can't have gotten better. If people think they're going to do big law after reading this, whatever, God bless them. The world needs a couple of sociopaths, I guess. Around page 24 or 25, he states, and I'm paraphrasing, that 2,000 billable hours may not seem like a daunting task, but the naive law student has yet to learn that they will only bill about 2 out of every 3 worked hours.
I've actually heard it's 2 out of every 4 at first. You just lack the skills, and so a lot of your work can't be billed.
Yep.
Anyways.
Assuming your commute takes you 45 minutes, then you will leave the house at 7:45 and arrive home each day at 7:15, 6 days a week, in order to make your 2,000-hour goal. Lawyers are extremely unhappy, and they're unhappy because they work too much. I haven't gotten all the way in yet, but Judge Schlitz, professor at Notre Dame Law when the article was written, I think, does provide some advice on how to be happy as a lawyer. And one of his pieces of advice, I'm pretty sure, is simply to avoid big firms. Thanks again, Chris. So, Ben, you skimmed it. I actually took a couple hours and read the whole thing.
Okay, nice.
Yeah. It should be required reading.
Yeah.
We'll share it. We'll put it in the show notes. We'll figure out how to get this out to y'all. You could also, I'm sure, just Google it. Vanderbilt Law Review, Judge Patrick Schlitz, S-E-H-I-L-T-Z. It's a 1999 law review article. Anyway, I did read the whole thing, and it got into a lot of reasons why lawyers are unhappy. But yeah, greed is one of the main ones. He talked about law firm culture is basically we're going to abuse the shit out of people for the first 1/3 of their law firm career because we need to take profit out of the firm. Well, the way we take profit out of the firm, the partners, right? The way the partners take profit out of the firm is they bill associates for more than they pay the associates. So they bill to the client more. Obviously, this is how profit works. Yeah. But they charge more for the associate's time than they pay the associate because they are the partner of the firm and they're going to take profit. So that's how the partners make, you know, millions. They pay you $200,000 a year in a big law firm, but they are making, you know, millions, 2 million, 4 million, mm-hmm. 20 million mm-hmm. a year as a partner of a big firm. And for the first third of your career, that's what they're going to do. They're basically pimping you out and taking profit.
Yeah.
For the middle one third of your career, you know, and maybe this is when you're a junior partner or a senior associate, junior partner. For the middle one third of your career, you are roughly break even. So they're compensating you roughly the same amount that you're bringing into the firm. And then for the later one third of your career, that's when you finally get paid back for all of the abuse you took during the first one third of your career. Mm-hmm. And this is why law firm culture can't ever change, because the people who are making the decisions at the top are the people who already paid their dues. And if they are the one out of 10 who make it to partner, well, now it's payback time.
Absolutely. What was the goal of sacrificing all that time and sanity?
Right.
Yeah. Interesting.
And it also talked a lot about the culture of big law life and, you know, the kind of keeping up with the Joneses, the way that insidiously your expectations of what kinds of vacations you go on and what kinds of it talked about like all these expensive habits that you pick up. You know, it's like, well, I make $200,000 a year. Of course, I'm going to drink the $100 a bottle wine or whatever. And you it's like totally unnecessary money that you're spending, but you just develop, all, you know, fancy suits and fancy cars, and you only have 4 days of vacation, but you fly to fucking Tokyo and back in those 4 days so that you can make the most of it. And you just like all these expenses that, you know, you just basically burn through all that money that you're making. And that just, you know, it's a self-reinforcing culture of misery. As far as the billing thing is concerned, you know, that billing 2 out of every 3 worked hours, he went into it a little bit more and started talking about how you also immediately start compromising your ethics almost on day one. And part of the reason why you're going to compromise your ethics are because of that crazy billing requirement that you'll start padding almost immediately. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you're going to do a 2-minute phone call and bill 15 minutes for it. Or you're going to be traveling, right? So 5-hour flight, New York to Los Angeles. Charge the client for your time. Also work on the plane and charge a different client for their time, for your time doing that.
Yeah.
And, you know, billable hours, right? And you can get away with it. So the culture really strongly encourages you, because who's telling you, like, who's telling you not to do that?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because just seems so blatantly wrong. But the title of this article is on being a happy, healthy, and ethical member of an unhappy, unhealthy, and unethical profession.
Yep. And that's the, you know, this isn't somebody bullshitting. This is a law professor and apparently now an actual judge. This is someone who has experience inside big law firms. And a law professor and a judge telling you that this is an unhappy, what is it? Unhealthy, unethical profession that you're getting yourself into. One of the main takeaways was don't do big law. Of course, when you're saying don't do big law, what you're also saying is don't make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that seems to be the main idea here is like, you can be happy, you can be healthy, you can be ethical, but you're probably not going to do that in the context of big law, which means you're probably not going to make big money, which means you really need to make sure that you don't impoverish yourself with student loan debt that will force you to then go chase the money in order to try to repay your loans. If you're going to be a public servant, if you're going to change the world, if you're going to be happy and healthy and ethical in this field, you know, you need to start by taking care of your financial future by essentially getting a scholarship to law school, or just don't go.
Yeah. Not becoming dependent on the field because you you basically took out a huge loan and now need the field to pay you back.
Yeah. And if I was in charge of, you know, the like put me in charge of the ABA section on legal education.
Yeah.
Or put me in charge of the U.S. Department of Education, making the determination whether law schools should get whether the loans should be funded by the U.S. Department of Education or loans guaranteed by the U.S. Department of Education. This law review article, again, from a law professor who is a judge, this law review article would be required reading for anyone who wants it to go to law school. You know, like, oh, you don't have time. You can't find an hour and a half to read this article before spending 3 years and hundreds of thousands of dollars. I can see it now. Like, I know that people are going to hear this and go, yeah, yeah, but I know that's not for me.
Yeah.
It's like, well, okay. You know, best of luck. But I think you should, you know, it's like people don't want to hear it because it's, I don't know. They just don't like, they don't like where it's headed, right? They don't like the conclusion. So they don't want to hear the evidence. But if you can't, you know, I think you should read it and then decide.
Well, it's interesting too. I'm looking at his very, very last section, right? It's titled Some Parting Words. I have mixed reactions to what he says at the end here. Let me read this, even though it's a little bit long. It says, to an unfortunate extent, this article has been an exercise in, quote, do what I say, not what I do. As I said, I joined a big law firm after I finished clerking, and despite the best of intentions, I quickly got sucked into the game. It is very, very hard to avoid the pressures and temptations pushing you toward the big firm. Very, very hard to avoid playing the game once you arrive at the big firm, and very, very hard to stop playing the game once you have left the big firm. I failed on the first two counts and continue to fail from time to time on the third. But I want to leave you with the following. By way of illustrating that it is never too late to change, even when you've failed as much as I have. My firm was lead counsel for the plaintiffs in the Exxon Valdez oil spill litigation. Remember that?
Yep.
Fiasco. In 1994, while I was still a partner, we won a judgment of over $5 billion. That would be a lot more today. We partners all knew that if and when we collected that judgment, even the smallest partner share would be a few hundred thousand dollars. Most of the partners would become millionaires. Because my wife and I would both be partners, we would enjoy two slices of this enormous pie. At about the time of the Exxon Valdez verdict, my wife and I were beginning to feel that somewhere along the line, we had lost our way. We were working constantly. Wait, what? Is that what that says? I don't know if that's what that says. Anyways, it's a word I don't recognize. We were under constant pressure. We were constantly feeling guilty about the hardships we were imposing on each other and on our children. The life we were leading was not the life we had envisioned. We had strayed from the values with which we were raised. In early 1995, we decided to leave big firm practice and to leave the Exxon money behind. We decided to give up a ton of money in return for work that was more enjoyable and less stressful and for more time with each other and our children. All of this we decided was more important than money, even lots and lots of money. Now, this is where I have like some like qualms. I don't claim that we made an enormous sacrifice. We did give up a lot of money, but we still get paid well and we have great jobs. Nor do I claim that we have stopped playing the game, that we have no regrets, that we never look back, and that we don't care about money anymore. None of that would be true. Living a balanced life and defining success for yourself are lifelong struggles, and they do not end once you leave a big law firm. The one thing I can promise you is that as we rediscover every day, they are struggles well worth undertaking. Okay, so my issue with this is that this is someone saying, hey, don't do big law, but clearly did big law and also reaped enormous benefits from it. I mean, quitting at this point, yeah, is giving up a lot of money, but this is also someone who has a lot of money and it's easy to quit.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, I think he would say, don't get into it in the first place. Right.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. That's the issue though. I'm taking, I guess is like, really, like, do you really think that you would have preferred the life that you you wouldn't have if you hadn't done this? I mean, he's probably extraordinarily wealthy because of these choices.
Sure.
I'm not a fan of, I'm not telling anyone to go do Big Law. I think the vast majority of people are going to be miserable, but it's weird coming from someone who made a lot of money from it.
We have an anonymous email. Go ahead, Ben.
Hey guys, I've gotten back into the groove of studying for the LSAT, comma.
Why does everybody do comma splices these days? I feel like every fucking email we see is just immediately comma splice in the first sentence.
Yeah, it's strange.
Put a period, y'all.
Yep.
Okay.
I've gotten back into the groove of studying for the LSAT, period. I feel relatively confident on LR, logical reasoning, and logic games, -0 to -2, because I'm able to stay focused and keep my attention on the questions. Oftentimes, I will get simple logic game questions wrong because I misread simple rules, forget to incorporate them, or misread a question. Despite a fair amount of practice, I keep making these same mistakes. Reading comp is a big problem for me. Ranges wildly from -0 to -6. I have pretty bad ADHD and I find myself unable to mentally focus while I'm reading large passages. Sometimes my brain will get foggy and I'll find myself skimming over multiple sentences with my eyes before realizing that I haven't been processing what I'm reading. I've tried active note-taking strategies to mitigate this, like highlighting or scribbling notes on scrap paper to outline a paragraph, but I don't know if this is working. I feel that most of my issues with the LSAT come from an inability to concentrate and focus. Do you have any advice in terms of study strategies, RC strategies, etc.? And anonymous spelled out etc., which is interesting.
Etc., yeah.
Yeah, to mitigate this issue. You know, I'm not an ADHD expert, so this is a little tough. I'm assuming, though, that the advice we give to everyone to slow down and make sure you understand each sentence would still have merit for you. I mean, we're telling people, read the sentence and make sure you can understand and, in most cases, visualize what you're reading. If you can't, then that's a clue right then and there that you weren't paying attention, that your mind drifted somewhere else, or that you just, you know, didn't grapple with the words enough. And so hopefully that could help you catch your wandering mind before it's been too long.
I recently read that book, yeah. ADHD 2.0.
Yeah.
I would definitely encourage you to read that book and see if you find anything in there that gives you tips for accommodating yourself. Beyond that, I mean, one thing that I say a lot is like, hey, well, you know, you are going to have to figure out how to compensate now. I recommend that you figure out how to compensate now, because this is only going to get worse in law school. I mean, if you find yourself skimming over multiple sentences with your eyes before realizing that you haven't been processing what you're reading, and you're doing that on the LSAT, wait till you see the type of shit that you're going to have to read in law school.
Yeah, an LSAT passage is 15 to 17 sentences long. Your reading assignments in law school cases are way longer, and they wander themselves, right? Sometimes it's like, where's the judge going with this?
Just
side
immensely
commentary?
More boring too.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, like the LSAT is fascinating. LSAT reading comp is fascinating compared to many of your assignments that you'll have to read right away in your first semester of law school. You're going to have to read shit that's way, way denser and boringer.
Yeah.
Than anything you're going to read on a short reading comprehension passage. If your eyes are glazing over now, fuck, like, wait till the print is way smaller. You know, those pages that have the kind of paper that they use in the Bible, because it's like thousands of pages, you know, the ultra thin tissue paper with the super tiny print.
Yeah.
And it's a 2000 page book. Oh. And it's like, I mean, like you've got to solve this, Anonymous. You got to figure out some strategies. So like, I hope you're not looking for LSAT tips, because this ain't an LSAT tips issue. This is a, you need to learn how to focus issue.
Yeah.
And it's probably a talk to your doctor, read up on your own ADHD, figure out some compensatory strategies for yourself, because yep, we're not ADHD experts. The other response that I have, and this is because it's partially what you're saying might not even be an ADHD. I mean, partially, I'm sure it is, but people without ADHD have the exact same complaint.
Yeah.
I have a hard time focusing. I space out. This stuff's boring. I'm not interested. And there I'm like, well, okay, you need to realize that this test is the primary determinant of where you're going to go and yeah, how much you're going to pay to go there.
Yeah.
This is the first step in your legal career. You need to start behaving like a lawyer, and lawyers don't get to say, oh, I was bored. Oh, I'm sorry. I spaced out. Like, that's just not a thing. You know, you don't, you're going to decide that you're the person who understands everything they read.
Yep.
You're either going to do that or you're not. Like, if you're not the person who understands everything they read, then what kind of a lawyer are you? So I'm not like trying to beat you up at all, but I am saying that like, this is not a thing that's going to be successful in the long run. So you've got to figure out how to get over that hump. And part of it is just realizing that like, you're not going to get to decide what to read. And you're not going to get to decide, you're not going to get to ignore boring things. You're not going to get to just allow yourself to space out. That's not what a lawyer is or does. You're going to be a professional student for the rest of your career.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, we could go back to Ben's, your first comment, I think, is the thing that people really need. But it's like you have to make a decision to do it, which is read one sentence or maybe the first half of the first sentence. And you have to force yourself to understand it.
Yep. And you know when you understand it because it clicks, right? You're like, ah,
yeah,
I get what you're saying. And if you're not getting that click, if you're not seeing it in your own head, what is being said,
yeah,
then you need to stop and you need to reread it. So you're catching yourself as you go.
Yeah. And for me, a lot of that is about predicting what I think is going to come next. So it's not like it'll make perfect sense every time, but it'll be like, okay, I think what you're saying is XYZ. Are you about to tell me ABC? Are you about to tell me PQR?
Yep.
Because I have objections S, T, and U. Is that where you're going with this? And if you're doing that, if you're having that kind of an interaction with the piece, whatever it is, then you're getting it. Like, it doesn't have to make perfect sense as if like, I understand your main point immediately based on your first sentence, because that's not a thing. They're not going to state their thesis in the first sentence. Their thesis is going to emerge in the course of 15 sentences, right?
Yeah.
But at the very beginning, in the first sentence, you should at least be able to say like, well, okay, I think that they're here to tell me, I think I'm about to hear more about whatever. And if not, then you need to reread it, because, you know, there needs to be something going in.
Yep.
At the beginning.
Yep. I agree. Predicting, right, in signals that you did pay attention in that first sentence.
Yeah.
It indicates that you're engaged, and it also primes you for what comes next. So even if what comes next is different from what you predicted, you're going to receive that information so much more effectively and quickly, faster than other people.
Right.
Right?
The point isn't to be right in your prediction. The point is to pay fucking attention.
Yeah.
It's like when I don't give a shit about a basketball game. And I am willing to make a wager on it. $5, I'll take either team. I don't care. And then I'll like actually maybe pay attention to who wins.
Yeah.
because I have some skin in the game. And now it's like, okay, I have a rooting interest at least. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what these predictions are in reading comp. And you can do it in logical reasoning as well. You know, you read the first sentence of a logical reasoning passage and you start making a prediction. Notice what Anonymous is suggesting here, you know, and poor Anonymous has read a bunch of other dumbass strategies. Active note taking, like highlighting or taking notes on scrap paper. I never would teach people to do any of that shit. Instead, think about it. Engage. Yep. You know, it's like nobody ever talks about engagement with the passage.
Yep.
Active notate. You know, make sure you're highlighting.
No, anyone can take notes. What? You can just literally hear words and then rewrite them down on the page.
Right. And that's what they do. They do that without understanding anything. It's like, oh, yep, that's important. I'm going to write it down. I don't understand it at all.
How do you even know if it's important?
I know.
It's crazy.
I know. Or like, why did you highlight that? Oh, I highlighted it because that's their main point. I look at it. No, it's not. Also, how would you have possibly known that that's their main point when you're reading it in the first sentence?
Or even in the middle of the passage, like it sounds like it might be the main point, but now I need to see evidence come after that and back it up. But heck, they might go on into a new direction and prove something else. Anyways,
I want to make one more comment. Anonymous is very concerned about variance.
Ranges wildly from -0 to -6 in reading.
Right. Comp. Right. I want to invite you, Anonymous. On Thursday, June 30th, I'm teaching a free class called What LSAT Score Variance Means.
Okay.
You can go to lsat.link/Nathan to sign up for that class. Free. 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. Again, on Thursday, June 30th, What LSAT Score Variance Means. And we're going to talk all about these wild variances that you're having.
Cool.
That's that.
We have another email here from Anonymous.
Anonymous writes us all the time.
Yeah. Who is this person?
Hi, Ben and Nathan. First of all, I hope you are both doing well. Are you doing well, Ben?
Yeah, I'm doing well. Thanks.
Ben's in his new office, by the way. He had to escape his family, his menagerie of kids.
Menagerie? I've never heard that word before.
You've never heard the word menagerie?
No,
I might not be pronouncing it right, but... And I think it refers to
Did you
animals.
Mean mayhem? Yes. Is that what you mean?
No, menagerie is a collection of wild animals kept in captivity for exhibition.
Okay, well, it's maybe not that bad, but, you know, I do have 4 boys and Maria's got a daughter and an older son. So, yeah, there's a lot of people.
And it's summer vacation. And so next thing I log on to record with Ben and I see the blue background behind him and I'm like, wait, what happened? He's like, I got the fuck out. Okay. To provide a little context before my question, I'm currently scoring in the low to mid 160s. For LR, I am able to complete about 20 questions. For LG, I'm able to complete 3 games and the 4th every once in a while. For RC, I'm able to complete 3 passages with about 3 to 4 minutes left for the last passage. I get about 0 to 1 questions wrong per section out of the ones I have time to attempt.
Okay. That's a wordy way of saying that you're getting essentially almost 100% correct on the questions you are doing.
Yeah, I rarely miss questions. I sometimes drop 1.
Got it.
When I later try to get the questions that I did not have time to attempt, I am able to get them all correct. This makes me feel as if the only thing keeping me out of the 170s right now is not being able to get more of each section done. Having been using Demon Live for some time, I understand the importance of not worrying about the clock and just focusing on accuracy. However, I have been at the same point in terms of how many questions I complete per section for a few months now, although my accuracy has increased. Based on this, do you think continuing to focus on accuracy and strengthening my understanding of the test itself will eventually translate to getting more questions done in each section? Thank you, et cetera, et cetera. Thank you for your help and making the LSAT easier one question at a time. Anonymous.
Okay, well, I think Anonymous is definitely heading down the right path. I'm glad that Anonymous is getting so many of these questions correct, but I want to start with games. So Anonymous says, for logic games, I am able to complete 3 games and the 4th every once in a while. It's totally possible to get 100% on the questions you do in games and not be doing them in a very effective way. It's good. It means you understand something about what's going on, but it's possible that you're right testing each individual answer choice, for example, as opposed to creating worlds or something like that. So at least in the games, I would say start by looking at the videos, start by trying to do the games in different ways to test out, you know, worlds using different base variables and so on. Yes, focus on accuracy, but also continue to strengthen your understanding so you get your mind wrapped around the test more. That will lead to speed.
Yeah, you're already right there on games. Yeah. I mean, you are sometimes getting the 4th one, so you're getting an inkling of what it's like. Mm-hmm. I think you just need to keep doing what you've been doing, but I, you know, not just on games, but on the entire test, I do want you to stay the course as far as continue to strengthen your understanding of the test itself. If you're ever going to go fast on games, it's because you solve the system up front, mm-hmm, with worlds or whatever, but you just make the deductions that are there to be made. And then you just answer all the questions in like a minute.
Yeah.
And you did do that on 1 or 2 of the games. And next thing you know, you finish the section on time.
Yeah.
On logical reasoning and reading comprehension, the way you're going to go fast is by predicting the answers and having the wrong answers look like shit so that you don't have to continue comparing answers to one another. Mm-hmm. Students that are slow, you're slow because you didn't understand enough when you read it. You didn't make a good enough prediction. You went into the answer choices hoping that A would be correct. You give A way too much respect. You give B way too much respect. You give C way too much respect. Next thing you know, you've got 2 or 3 contenders, mm-hmm, and you're comparing bullshit to other bullshit, which hopefully includes one of them is not bullshit. One of them is the right answer. Sometimes you're comparing 2 wrong answers to one another. Mm-hmm. That doesn't sound like it's happening to Anonymous, because Anonymous is getting most of these questions right. But the way you're going to go fast is by dismissing wrong answers just right off the bat. Like you read 3 words and you're like, nope, next. The thing, so I don't want Anonymous to fall into the trap of, like right now, let's say Anonymous is getting 20 questions. Anonymous obviously wants to get 25 questions.
Yep.
But that's not what Anonymous should be thinking about. Anonymous should be thinking about confidently, accurately, getting 20 in a row right. And then magic just, oh, wait a minute, I have 3 minutes left. And doing number 21. Mm. Because if you keep doing what you've been doing, Anonymous, all you have to do is get to one more question. You know, maybe it'll happen in the next couple of weeks. You get to one more question each section, but you get it right without compromising your accuracy on the first 20. Mm-hmm. And next thing you know, it's like every single question you get right increases your LSAT score by a point.
Yeah.
Right now, low to mid 160s, but one more question per section, now you're in the mid to high 160s.
Yeah.
And then one more question on top of that, and now you're in the high 160s, knocking on the door of 170.
Yeah.
So it's like, really, it's like a total of 2 more questions per section. I mean, games for sure. Like you need that 4th game. But you're not going to get there by rushing. In fact, you're going to get there by spending more time on your setups so that the questions go more quickly. And then on logical reasoning and reading comp, you're not going to get there by rushing to the answer choices. You're going to get there by understanding more of the passage, making better predictions, and then just knocking out like the wrong answers should start to look like absolute shit. And when they do, that's when you're going to be just kind of cruising through the section. You're still going to be getting them all right. They're just all going to seem really easy.
Yeah.
And then, you know, yeah, you don't have to finish. You just, you know, you just easily, naturally, without even trying.
Yeah.
Get the first 20 in a row right and then have a few minutes left and do one more.
Yeah.
I really hope that the student does not change their strategy and like start trying to finish sections or, you know, like, well, I need to make sure that I'm like, keep it moving. Like, oh, I got to get the first 10 in 10 minutes or whatever like that.
Yeah.
I feel like would be a disaster because the student would start dropping some of the easier earlier questions and then also potentially cause themselves speed problems, ironically, because they would all of a sudden they'd be like, well, this test felt really hard.
I do want to double down on what you're talking about when it comes to the answer choices. I feel like that's where most of the speed gains end up taking place.
Yep.
As you understand the test better, because as you understand the test better, you start to see more than one reason why so many of these answers are wrong, which means you can see the first reason, right? As opposed to the last reason. And then you're like, you read three words and you're like, nope, sorry, that's wrong for this reason. I'm out of here. Whereas other people are reading that entire answer. They're getting to the end of that answer and then they see why it's wrong, which is great. So you got your accuracy down, but you're still like your understanding of the test is not as complete as others.
That's really interesting. In class, sometimes I have the experience of I will confidently eliminate an answer that I've only read the first half of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then students will chime in and go, but isn't D actual? They'll say actually, but isn't D actually wrong because of this reason?
Yeah. Yeah.
And frequently it's a better reason.
It can be a better reason. Yep.
It's like, well, yeah, that too.
And that really kills it, but so did the first one. So it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I confidently eliminated that answer.
Mm-hmm.
It's like maybe I hadn't even arrived at really a very clear reason why I was dismissing that answer. It was like my spidey sense just told me it wasn't the answer.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's like that because that's how it's done. That's the difference between hoping answers are right and expecting answers to be wrong. I'm expecting answers to be wrong. So it's like, no, I already saw an answer that I like, or no, I know what I'm looking for. And when I read the first half of an answer that has an 80% chance of being wrong, I got a quick trigger. I don't need to be 100% sure that I'm eliminating that answer. Like I don't have to justify why I'm not picking that answer.
Mm-hmm.
I only have to justify why I am picking the answer that I pick.
Yeah.
And as long as I feel good enough about that answer that I'm picking, then these wrong answers, I couldn't have been right. Like the first few words it was going off in the wrong direction. See, that's not a clear articulation of why it is conclusively wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But in the moment, that's how I actually would have dismissed it. I would have just been like, I wouldn't have had the patience for it. I would have been like, whatever you're going to fucking talk about. Like, I'm sure you're going to be wrong for whatever reason.
Yeah.
That's where the speed comes from. You know, you're not an LSAT teacher. When you're doing the test, you're not an LSAT teacher. You're not writing a book about this question. Again, you do not have to justify why you're not picking that answer. Now, you should be able to. And when you're reviewing, you should be like, oh, shit, I missed this one.
Yeah.
What did I do here? Uh-oh, I picked a wrong answer. That's a mistake. I also didn't pick the right answer. That's a mistake. So maybe there, you know, you dismissed that answer too quickly. And if that's happening a lot, then you're not as good as you think you are. And maybe you do need to slow down a little bit. But if you're like anonymous and you're sometimes, you know, if he's saying he's or he or she is getting -0 frequently, well, then maybe you do need to let go of those wrong answers a little bit more easily. Because you know what a right answer feels like.
Yeah. Yeah, it's certainly possible that you're talking yourself through each wrong answer. And you need to do less of that.
Right.
Yeah. So there are these answers that you're getting rid of before you even finish them because they're going in the wrong direction. And maybe you can't clearly articulate why they're wrong, but it's like, no, not good. And I have this other one that is good. But there are also plenty of cases where it's like, I'm reading the first four words and it's not like, oh, it doesn't seem right. It's like, no, that's
wrong. This is explicitly wrong. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, I got a real quick trigger. I know it's wrong 4 out of 5 times. Yep. So I read those first few words, and if it could be totally wrong,
mm-hmm.
or it could be going off and meandering. And in either case, I'm going to provisionally say, nope, that's not the answer.
Yeah.
Now, that means that I will sometimes eliminate all five. Eliminate mm-hmm. all five. You know, mm-hmm. just I won't love any of them on the first time through. And that's yeah. when, okay, now I got to be a little bit more generous. Give them a little bit more patience, but still I'm going to be like first four words. No, that one is wrong. Goodbye.
Yeah.
Some of them I'll have to read the whole thing and go, no, that's wrong. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Yeah.
And then one of them that I might've dismissed too hastily on the first time through, mm-hmm. I'll read the whole thing and I'll go, oh, okay. I see you. I thought you were meandering, but it turns out you righted the ship and you actually answered the question and that's correct. So I'll pick it. Because I'm not going to pick any of the wrong answers, right? But like on the first time through, I guess that maybe that's, this is a long way of getting around to this, but that's a question that we could ask anonymous. When someone says something like this, I would be curious, how often are you eliminating all five answers on your first time through?
Mm-hmm.
Because you should probably be doing that sometimes. And if you're never doing that, then I definitely have that suspicion that you're, you know, trying to justify why wrong answers are wrong.
Yeah, I guess the point here is that when we say focus on accuracy, we want you to focus on doing this test correctly. We don't want you to be sloppy. We want you to read and understand and be careful. But really, what we're saying is make sure you're being careful with the passage, being careful with the question. But as you start to get into the answers, not that we want you to misread things, but this is where you can be more aggressive.
Yeah, because, yeah, careful with your prediction and careful with the answer you pick. I mean, with you're vouching you for pick, that answer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You do have to justify why you're picking the answer. You should be able to defend the answer that you're picking.
Yep.
But the answers that you're not picking, you're not picking them. So, yeah, I mean, you read it and it just didn't smell right. You know, you looked at it. Nah, I don't think so.
Yeah,
that's fine. I mean, that's really how we're doing it normally, right? Mm-hmm. You're not sitting there, Ben. You're not like actually articulating exactly why you're dismissing every answer. You're just reading it and going, I don't.
Yeah. And that's why, too, sometimes in class, people are like, well, that question took a long time to like get through. You know, would you spend that long on the actual LSAT? And it's like, well, no, because we're talking, and two, because I'm trying to help you see why this answer is wrong. But in a lot of cases, like I would have just moved on.
Yeah. In real life, I would have just like known that they weren't going where they needed to go and just said goodbye.
Yeah.
It's like probably half the answers are like that.
Yeah.
We have an email here from Jason.
Hello, I'm new to your content and have found your podcast very insightful. I recently graduated undergrad this December and decided to take a break from higher education and obtain work experience. I currently work at a mid-sized law firm as a trust and estates paralegal. Is this a valuable way to be spending my time? How will schools view this? As well, what kind of success do you see with individuals to study for the LSAT while working full-time? Here is some further information. I took a diagnostic and scored a 149. My goal is to get a score as high as possible to not incur any debt. What should a timeline be for me to take the LSAT while working full time? Okay, well, let's start with the first question. Is this a valuable way to be spending my time as a trust and estate paralegal?
Maybe, but not for the reason you think.
Yeah, you think this is good for your application.
Maybe. Well, yeah. I mean, Jason says, how will schools view this? And the answer is mostly they won't. I mean, mostly they don't give a shit. They care about your LSAT and your GPA. So, I mean, they're going to start with that. They're going to take your LSAT times a constant plus your GPA times a constant. They're going to turn your numbers into one number. And they're going to use that. They call that an index number. They're going to calculate your one number and rank you versus all other applicants.
Yep.
And if you're super high, they're going to be like, oh, wow, we're going to admit this guy no matter what he has on his resume. And if you're super low, they're probably not going to admit you no matter what you have on your resume. So it's like, you know, the reason to do this is because maybe you want to work in trust and estates as a lawyer. If you do, and you're getting valuable experience and making contacts, then it's a valuable use of your time. If you're well paid, it could be a valuable use of your time.
Yeah. Or just figuring out whether you want to be in this kind of an environment, right? Like,
but if you've already figured out that you hate it and or you're underpaid, then it's a terrible use of your time.
And you shouldn't even be going to law school, maybe.
Or, well, you should be investigating some other area of law that you think you might actually be interested in. There's a pretty damn big difference between a trust and estates attorney and a criminal defense attorney.
Sure. But there are a lot of similarities, too. So if you kind of hate this general vibe, right?
If you hate lawyers, if you think lawyers are dicks and you just can't imagine continuing to talk to these people for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably just stop there. Don't do anything for law school applications purposes. Like, don't arrange your life for law school admissions, except to the extent that you get as good of undergrad grades as you can and you get the best LSAT you can.
Yep.
Those are the things that you should be spending your time on. Jason's already done with undergrad. Congratulations and or condolences if you have low grades. Your LSAT career, though, is in full swing, and that should really be your priority. I mean, no job is worth sacrificing your LSAT if you're serious about law school.
Now, to be clear, that doesn't mean you need to quit your job. If it pays your bills and you still can get home at a decent hour and study with focus either before work or after work, then for a lot of people, it's actually better to have a job and study for the LSAT than to try to study for it full time. So work is just a secondary thing.
Sure. And yeah, what kind of success do we see with individuals that study for the LSAT while working full time?
That's most people.
Most people are either school full time or work full time or some combination of school and work. Yeah, so our students are busy, productive people mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't even differentiate them. I expect that most of our students are doing something full time or combination full time.
Jason's diagnostic was a 149 reactions.
That's a damn good diagnostic. You know, it's not as good as the 159 that we were looking at earlier, but 149, I would bet, you know, that within a few months, we should be able to get you into the mid 160s. I wouldn't be shooting for 170 right out of the gate. You know, you need to get to 155. And then you got to get to 160, and then you got to get to 165. So I would be looking for incremental progress. You know, can you get to 155 in a month? Something like that. And if so, then, you know, I think you potentially, Jason, could be taking the LSAT this fall.
Mm-hmm.
I'd probably not be trying to apply this cycle. It's June right now, and Jason hasn't taken an official LSAT at all. I think you should probably be looking to apply in fall of 2023 to start law school in fall of 2024. And you could take the LSAT as many as 5 times between now and fall of 2023 applications.
Yeah.
So I'm not telling you that you should take it 5 times necessarily, but law schools are only going to care about your highest score. So you should do practice tests to gauge where you're at. As soon as those practice test numbers start to look like numbers that are going to get you to the school you want to go to at the price you want to pay, then you should start taking the official LSAT. Then you should keep prepping, keep practicing, keep taking the official LSAT until your highest official LSAT on record is going to get you the scholarship that you want. And you can check that at lsatdemon.com/scholarships. Email daily at lsatdemon.com if you'd like to ask us a question or share some LSAT or law school admissions news. Thanks for listening.